It is The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Chirkin. Thanks for being here. Now to the credit card industry and steps to better track firearms sales. The International Organization for Standardization approved what is known as a merchant category code for firearms stores. Major credit cards like Visa are adopting the change. Some gun control advocates call the development a major step forward. Join in on how you think firearm sales should be categorized on your credit card statement, 800-642-1234. Lee Williams is chief editor of the Second Amendment Foundation's Investigative Reporting Project. The nonprofit supports gun rights and is based in Washington State. Lee, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation, Kate.
Well, let's talk about this merchant category codes, four-digit numbers used to classify businesses. Explain this new development in these codes.
Well, taking a step back, in my humble opinion, I don't think it matters what your position is on the Second Amendment. Every civil libertarian out there should be alarmed by this move. It was created by and started by a group called the Amalgamated Bank, which is not really a bank like you or I would know. It's more of a political project. They are the ones that pushed this through the ISO, which you mentioned earlier, and got the code. If you take a look at the bank's website, you'll see that they partner with many organizations on the left, and they're pretty anti-gun. They've said that it's important for banks to support political candidates, political parties, political action committees that oppose the Second Amendment, and they're very much for progressive change. It seems to us that through this, by using this code, it creates a gun registry. It'll create a registry of everybody who shops at a gun store. And that is, if the federal government was doing it, that would be illegal under several federal laws. So through this, and this is my point, it seems that the Biden-Harris administration who pushed Amalgamated Bank into doing this, has privatized civil rights violations. Now, this isn't the
pause? I just want to flesh that out a bit, because the bank that applied for this change, as you say, Amalgamated Financial, said basically this is about compliance and risk. And they argued that it was necessary to identify credit risk. And I think the bank's president said to fully comply with our duty to report suspicious activity and illegal gun sales to authorities without blocking or impeding legal gun sales. Do they have a point?
No, I don't think they do. They haven't even defined what a suspicious gun sale would be. Just the other day I bought a case of rifle ammunition and a case of pistol ammunition. It's 1,000 rounds of each. Would that have been suspicious? I needed them because that weekend I was taking a training class. I get two or three pistols shipped to me, which would be considered by the ATF a suspicious and possible straw purchase. But I review the pistols and write product reviews. I think they're putting the cart way in front of the horse. And if you look at Visa's response to this, Visa pushed back hard against this. Visa was concerned that it would violate the privacy of their members. And we see this as the second attempt by the Biden-Harris administration to privatize, to get away with something that federal law and the Constitution prevent them from doing. I mean, just look at how they pressured big tech to censor stuff on Facebook and Twitter and other social media groups. That would have been a clear violation of the First Amendment if the Biden-Harris administration had done it. So they pressured big tech into it.
Going back to Visa for a moment, the world's largest payment processor, they cautioned us about reading too much into this new code and trying to connect a new merchant code for gun sellers as a means to interfere with, lawful sales. Is this change being blown out of proportion here?
I don't think so. It creates a registry of gun owners, something the administration has wanted, something the ATF has tried to do twice, and we caught them both times. Several federal laws prevent the government from creating a list of gun owners, a gun registry, which is what this does. It lets everybody that shops at a gun store.
We're talking about a new credit card vendor code that will track firearm purchases made from gun vendors. Lee Williams is here, works for the nonprofit, the Second Amendment Foundation. You can join in with your insights at 800-642-1234. You know, prior to this decision, gun store sales, Lee, were classified under categories like general merchandise or sporting goods. Is that more suitable?
Yeah, I believe so. I think you just have to look at what Visa said in their statement about this. And I'm quoting, "We believe that asking payment networks to serve as a moral authority by deciding which legal goods can or cannot be purchased sets a dangerous precedent. We understood Amalgamated Bank's request to be justified at least in part, but an interest in blocking transactions that would fall under such a new category, and Visa's rules expressly prohibit blocking of legal transactions under an MCC. What concerns me most, Kate, is what they consider a suspicious purchase. Now, we are all about blocking true, legitimate, suspicious purchases and keeping firearms and ammunition out of the hands of prohibited people. But they said they're creating an algorithm that would tell you what Amalgamated said they're creating an algorithm that would tell you what suspicious purchases are. I would really like to see that.
How would you prefer credit card companies code this or account, you know, for these firearm stores? How should they be categorized?
General purchase, general stuff, you know, like it, exactly like it was before. When, by doing this, they now create a list of people that shop at gun stores, which is a de facto gun registry that's been privatized. It's been outsourced to private companies. I believe NRA said it best when they said they Amalgamated has been deputized to create by the government to create a gun registry. And that is truly concerning, especially now when you look at some of the other actions that the administration is taking on our firearms.
What about big box stores that sell rifles and handguns and ammunition? Will they have this merchant code or a different one?
They will. I assume they will. If they're going to be selling firearms on credit, I assume they're going to have the same MCC, the merchant category code.
So like Gander Mountain and stores like that would also use this type of merchant code?
I'm not sure. Is Gander Mountain still in business?
I'm not actually sure either, but I'm thinking about the large sporting goods type stores that do sell firearms. Would those be a different code, or are these specific to only gun stores that sell just guns?
According to the ISO, it would be for firearm retailers. So I imagine if there's still a big box store left that's selling firearms, they would have to use this code when they're selling firearms.
Let's take a call now. Cindy is with us from Menominee Falls. Cindy, what's on your mind?
Hello. I have a question. You've been talking about these merchant codes for the purchase of firearms. And first of all, I'm curious, are there merchant codes for other types of purchases like furniture, household goods, things of that nature? And secondly, I guess if there's upset over this so-called gun registry, where was the outrage over the mattress registry or the sofa registry?
Cindy, thank you. Lee, go ahead.
Well, I'll start with the last part first. You don't have a constitutional right to own a sofa or a mattress. You do have a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. And the Second Amendment prevents the government from infringing upon that right. So that's where the outrage is, because this seems to be an infringement that has been outsourced to private companies.
There's concern that this could also lead to other codes in the future, codes that could be used to track other politically charged businesses like abortion providers. Is that possible?
Yeah, I see once these things become in common usage and used for political reasons, I don't see it stopping.
We're discussing new merchant codes for processing firearm sales and the reaction from the credit card industry. Lee Williams is with the Second Amendment Foundation's Investigative Reporting Project. Join in on credit card purchase tracking, how you feel about merchant codes, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the credit card industry categorizing sales at gun shops with a new merchant code for gun shops. One question that rises to the surface, how will credit card companies determine if a gun purchase is suspicious? And would this open the door to other types of transaction tracking? Join in 800-642-1234. Lee Williams is here, chief editor at the nonprofit Second Amendment Foundation Investigative Reporting Project, stays with us. Let's bring in Andrew now in Palmyra. Andrew, go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi.
So one point that I wanted to mention is that this is kind of a fascist sort of relationship that the government is trying to get into with credit card companies, and they're doing it because they know that on a legislative level they can't do it because it's a constitutionally protected right, so they're using private companies to go and enforce their policies. But my question is if they can do this on firearms today, what says that they won't apply this same approach to people who want to go and buy cigarettes or people who want to buy alcohol or, you know, red meat down the line? Say that's, you know, something that the government believes people shouldn't be able to buy, or that it should be tracked and limited. So I just want people to consider that.
Andrew, thank you. Lee, what are your concerns there?
I agree with Andrew. I think that it could be misused. Say you want to donate to a certain political party by credit card, that could end up being tracked. This is clearly, in my humble opinion, an attempt by the government to circumvent federal law. This is a workaround. They know that they can't track gun sales because of the Second Amendment, so they privatized it out. And as we said earlier, our biggest concern is what constitutes a suspicious purchase, and that has not been answered. And if you look, we're not the only ones raising objections. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik out of New York and 100 of her colleagues have sent a letter to Visa, MasterCard, and American Express expressing their concerns about this firearm retailer, MCC. So there are a lot of people that are worried about this.
This new merchant code, some analysts say, researchers say, is very limited because in a 2016 Justice Department survey of people incarcerated in federal and state prisons, only 7% of them had a gun while committing their offense that had purchased that weapon under their name from a licensed dealer. So this idea that, that tracking guns for this regard for illegal purposes seems more limited because, you know, guns are gotten from other ways, like a black market deal.
You just reaffirmed our case, Kate. None of these, and if you look at the Biden-Harris administration's gun control agenda, and I've written about it, and it was a long story because we tried to cover all aspects of it. Nothing in there, not one thing, is designed to disarm the bad guys, disarm the criminals. Every single thing in there is concerned about disarming law-abiding citizens and keeping and making it more difficult for a law-abiding citizen to obtain firearms. So I think you get it now, what we're looking at. We're all about getting and disarming the bad guys, but this certainly doesn't impact that at all. Yet it will serve as a good mechanism for the administration to track gun purchasers and create a registry of gun owners.
Wouldn't gun buyers then just use cash instead of credit cards to purchase a firearm if that transaction is happening above board at a gun shop?
I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that there are a few dealers right now that are buying counting machines. Yeah, but it also would kill online firearm sales. And there's a big misnomer about that. You can't buy a firearm online without a background check. But you can go to dozens and dozens of websites out there, find something you like, purchase it, and then it is shipped to your local dealer where you have to go pick it up and go through a background check. So I would this targets online gun sales. It would make them more difficult for people who do not want to end up on a federal registry. But yeah, cash is king. You're absolutely right.
Payment systems like Apple Pay and PayPal have banned the sale of guns on their platforms. And, you know, credit card companies could follow suit. If more platforms ban gun sales, how might that affect the industry?
Well, the industry is, pardon the pun, booming right now. Joe Biden has turned into more of a gun salesman than his predecessors, any of his predecessors. Right
but,
now, it's
but
it,
let me just let's pause there for a moment because, you know, violence is booming, if you should say, in those horrible terms. I mean, look at the violence happening in our cities. How do you curb that violence and get guns off the street?
Well, like you said earlier, these people are not buying their guns from gun dealers, these criminals. They're getting them the old-fashioned way. They're stealing them. I think the best way to do it, especially in some of these big cities, is to take the reins off the cops and let them go get them. There are over 100,000 documented gang members in the city of Chicago. The cops know who they are. Chicago PD's had a gang unit since the 20s when they ran around after a guy named Al Capone. Unfortunately, it is the administration that has got these cops there restrained. And I used to be in law enforcement before I became a journalist. Let the cops go. Let them go out there and arrest the bad guys. And then we also need district attorneys and state attorneys who have the wherewithal to put these guys in prison rather than this catch and release crap that's going on now. That's how you cut down on violence in major cities.
Let's go to Chris in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hello. I'm just not a constitutional expert, so I was kind of just wondering how exactly the government, you know, keeping track of gun sales is against the Second Amendment. And then I do have a comment about what was just said. It's my understanding that most of the guns that are seized in Chicago are actually legally obtained in bordering states like Minnesota and Wisconsin. So I kind of would just expect you to know that since you're in law enforcement. I'll take my comments up here. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Chris. Lee, go ahead.
Yeah, I would love to see more intelligence on where these guns are purchased that are caught in crimes. And there are numerous federal statutes that prohibit the government from creating a gun registry. I don't have them all at my tip. They're not contained in the Second Amendment, although I would consider that an infringement. But numerous federal laws prohibit the government from creating a gun registry.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about a new credit card vendor code, merchant code, that would be used by gun store vendors. Lee Williams is with the nonprofit, the Second Amendment Foundation, that is opposed to this, says that it would create a nationwide gun registry. What do you think? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Lee, it seems that your group is aligning part and parcel with the NRA, which is also vehemently opposed, calling this, in your words as well, creating a national registry of gun owners. Do you feel like you are in lockstep with what the NRA is saying on this issue?
I think we're in lockstep with any civil libertarian. I mean, this is clearly an assault on the Second Amendment. Of course, Second Amendment groups are going to oppose this because this could, right now, in Joe Biden's America, our rights are under assault. And we could talk for hours about the broad, sweeping anti-gun agenda that his administration is pushing. So I'm pretty sure every pro-gun group, every civil libertarian group out there would look at this and say, yeah, this is something we oppose, just like the credit card company Visa did, too.
So you will oppose it, your group will, but you're not explaining how will you fight it? How will you stop it?
I'm on the educational side. Second Amendment Foundation right now has ongoing litigation, last time I checked, in 35 states, including some states with multiple lawsuits. This is going to have to be a legal matter, no doubt in my mind.
So when you say litigation, what is the litigation going after? Can you explain that?
Well, I would hope we would try and stop this from being implemented. Because this is clearly a civil rights violation that's just been outsourced to private companies. I'm not an attorney. I'm just a journalist and a former cop. We have plenty of attorneys that work for Second Amendment Foundation that are infinitely more smarter than me when it comes to what exactly would be targeted by the lawsuit.
We only have a little time left, but as you watch this merchant code go into effect, it's only been in effect, I guess, for a week or so. What happens next as you look at litigation starting? What else will you be watching for?
We'll be looking to see, especially if any of these gun dealers are hit or gun purchases are hit with what we call what they're calling a suspicious purchase. I'm very interested if any of these purchases are stopped because they're considered suspicious, because nobody has yet been able to define exactly what that means.
Lee, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Lee Williams is chief editor of the Second Amendment Foundation's Investigative Reporting Project. The organization that supports gun rights is based in Washington State. Up ahead, we learn why a third of Wisconsin restaurant owners feel business is worse now than 3 months ago. You can join in on your establishment, your restaurant, how it's doing. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News update and a story from Wisconsin Life are next on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to what it's like running a restaurant in Wisconsin in these times. The Wisconsin Restaurant Association, with more than 7,000 members, is out with new survey data from restaurant operators. And they sum it up this way. Running a restaurant now is akin to a daily turn at the game Jenga. If you remove one more support in the business, will that be the one that causes everything to come tumbling down? And if I'm reading that metaphor correctly, join in on food service, the restaurant industry, what you're experiencing, 800-642-1234. Danielle Bearwald is here, board chair of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, owns Irv's Mug in Oak Creek. Danielle, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Can you explain the Jenga game feelings that restaurant operators are expressing through this survey?
Well, and as everyone's aware, the last couple of years have been really difficult, especially on restaurants who are forward-facing and serving the public, and went through a pretty difficult struggle and turned and adapted it at every challenge that was thrown at us over the last couple of years. But recently, as coming out of this, these challenges, we're facing the same increased costs that everyone is seeing at home. You know, our food, our utilities, our rent, all of those things are up. And adding to that is the increase in labor costs, which, while that's a wonderful benefit for our employees to I'll be earning more money. That is a cost of doing business, not just our business, but every business, that has increased dramatically in the last couple of years. So while people are coming in the door, they're paying more to do so, which is, of course, our last choice would be to raise prices. But I think in some cases, it's inevitable.
And you know, I would imagine your patrons expect some of that. I mean, you're going to have to pass along these costs because certainly those diners are seeing those costs go up everywhere else in their lives.
Of course, of course. And again, it is our last choice to do that. You know, the revenue only comes in through the front door. That's the only place that restaurants make money, is when customers come in. And it's, you're in a crossroads between raising the prices enough to keep the doors open or potentially going out of business.
And perhaps then leading into the survey data, this new survey data, 40% of restaurant operators say their business will never return to normal. Another nearly 40% of operators say the return to normal won't happen soon. What can you pinpoint why, you know, restaurant operators are so bearish on the future and perhaps the forever?
I would agree with the latter part of that. It's the forever. I don't think that there is a return to normal. Me personally, I think there's a new normal. We're in it. And I think the labor side of this equation is not going to get any better anytime soon. And there's no quick fix for it. It's a multifaceted issue and it affects everything we do. Obviously, if I don't have enough people to open, it doesn't matter what my prices are or what my hours are or how good my food is. I can't open the doors if I don't have enough people.
we looked at labor recently. A UW-Madison State of Labor study says conditions are broadly improving for Wisconsin workers. And let's listen to economist Laura Dresser on our show last week.
It's not that people kind of backed away from work, and that's what describes or defines these shortages. Workers have really seen opportunity and have moved to better jobs. So we have more people working, and we have a higher labor force participation rate today than we did last summer.
So people are working, Danielle. How does the restaurant and hospitality industry then recruit and retain these workers?
Well, I think she's, of course, right in saying that people are working. I believe that. But I believe that people are also working perhaps less. There is a much louder narrative regarding things like a shorter work week and work-life balance and all of those wonderful things for our employees. But what that equates to for the restaurant industry is an industry that looks to fill positions when we're most busy, which is nights and weekends. We don't have the people to do that. We traditionally filled those busy weekend nights with people that were looking to work a second job to make ends meet. Well, as people's wages went up and they sought that work-life balance that we all talk about, they aren't willing to give up their weekends to work a second job. And that is great for their home life. It's really bad for the busy Friday night fish fry and making sure we have enough people to take care of you.
What do you think of restaurants being blatantly honest to patrons, you know, putting up a sign that says, "We're short-staffed, thanks for your patience"? Or is that transparency a bit taboo now in dining?
Well, I think it's important. I don't think it's news to anyone that the world is short-staffed. You know, the signs, "Thank you, you know, thank the people who showed up to work today." I think it's become very accepted into the fabric of the restaurant industry that people are maybe perhaps seeing it as an excuse for not doing better. It's not for lack of trying, believe me. We've been trying to hire on our workforce since at least the beginning of the year, and I don't even have someone applying for the job, yet alone picking a good candidate. I have no candidates. I have 6 jobs open and not a single application.
When was your last job applicant?
In early 2021.
Wow, that's a long time ago. What about retaining your employees? Do they stick with you?
They do. I am very, very lucky to have very long-time employees. 10 years in my business is not at all uncommon. The majority of my staff have been there 8 to 15 years. I work really hard to keep the people that work hard for me.
Do you know why they stay?
We try to provide flexibility and time off, flexible work schedules to accommodate children's schedules, spouses' schedules, anything we can. We've closed 2 days in part because of being short-staffed, but also in part to provide those 2 days back-to-back off time that the regular 9-to-5 world sees. We've closed on Sundays and Mondays. I don't see those days ever coming back. They're really necessary for that mental health aspect of having some guaranteed time off.
Danielle Bearwald, board chair of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, with us, advocating on behalf of the industry, the association, owner of a restaurant in Oak Creek. Join in on food service in these times. Low unemployment, changes you notice at your favorite restaurant, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Restaurant Association has new survey data out from thousands of restaurant operators queried nationwide. Business conditions are weakening in our state, economic pessimism growing. Join in on your assessment of the food service industry, especially if it's your lifeblood. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Restaurant owner Danielle Bearwald with us, board chair of the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Let's bring in Jeremy now in Sheboygan. Jeremy, what's your assessment?
Hey, I own a bar that serves food and some escape rooms in a family entertainment center in Sheboygan. And I'm not hurting for staff. I've got a small team, a well-thought-out business plan, and I pay my employees more than the people next door do. I offer a tremendous amount of workplace dignity, work-life balance, and flexibility. But my big comment, I've been in the hospitality industry for almost my entire life. I've seen a lot. And one thing I haven't seen is the wage for servers going up. Nor have I really seen the working conditions in small business, in small restaurants improve for line level staff. What are we doing if our business plans for restaurants are so poor that we're still paying our servers $2, $3, $4 an hour? And then what is the Wisconsin Restaurant Association doing with its owning member base to increase the dignity of the workers, in Wisconsin? The working conditions for restaurants, servers get yelled at, cooks get yelled at. There's a ton of abuse and a ton of really, really, really just poor business practices. What has the Wisconsin Restaurant Association done to protect the workers from bad owners?
Jeremy, thank you. Danielle, go ahead.
Well, I appreciate the comments, Jeremy, and I applaud you in having a great workforce. That is certainly not the norm, not just for our industry, but for many, many industries out there. The Restaurant Association takes an active part in education, not just for owners, but for staff. And I guess educating the staff that this treatment that you speak of is not the norm. And if you are working for someone like that, you should look elsewhere. I agree with you 100% that any owner who is allowing the degrading behavior that you speak of deserves to be short-staffed. People shouldn't be treated like that, no matter what industry they're working in. As far as the tipping industry, now you indicate that servers are making $2.50, $3, $4 an hour. That is their tipped wage. They are guaranteed by law to make at least the minimum wage, which is woefully low. I will certainly support that idea, but they are guaranteed by law to make at least the minimum wage with their tip supplements. And tipped workers are overwhelmingly in support of maintaining tipped wages. So the restaurant industry will help to continue to support what our industry has indicated, which is that our servers, our bartenders, those who work in traditional tipped positions want to remain tipped employees. And that doesn't mean that a restaurant can't choose to pay their employees more, and they often do.
And I do feel like tipping requests are everywhere now. And even when we had that moment where some places said, nope, it's a living wage here, no tips, please. My guess is that it's also easy to ask for a tip when everything almost is moving through card readers and screens. Where is the association at with the state of tipping?
The association is in support of maintaining a tipped wage, as has been overwhelmingly indicated by the people who work for tipped wages. And I say people distinguished from members. We're talking about employees who work for members, and this is nationwide, have indicated resoundingly that they want to maintain tipped employment. And so the association continues to support a tipped wage.
Why do you think that is, that they want those tips there?
Because that's how we attract employees. I don't have any employees that are making even close to minimum wage. They're 2 to 3 to 4 times what minimum wage is. Some of those are tipped employees. if my people who are paid something less than the minimum wage, they're paid in the tip wage, they're paid $2, $2.50, $3, $4, $6 an hour. If they were truly making that wage, they would not still be working for me. My servers average 9 to 15 years in service. One of them's been with me over 40. She is not making that hourly.
Danielle Bearwald, board chair for the Wisconsin Restaurant Association. Joshua now in Stevens Point. Joshua, go ahead.
Yeah, I had just kind of some thoughts about this. I worked in the restaurant industry for about, I'd say 12 years. It was my first job at 16, and I worked in it till I was about 27. My thoughts on it are the restaurant industry is falling short because, I mean, COVID, when everything shut down, it gave people, most people that work in restaurants, in my experience, are low income. It's just the way it is because can't afford to pay employees $20 an hour, $18 an hour, $21 an hour with the, you know, just the income that a restaurant gets, especially small restaurants, mom and pop restaurants. So I think what happened with COVID, it gave these people, A, the extra income with unemployment, that $600 a week. It gave them time to find better paying jobs, whether it be staying at home, working remotely, making, you know, I live in Stevens Point, and I know a ton of people went to work for Century making $20 an hour, you know, and you don't even need an education. So it gave COVID shutdowns, gave people a chance to find a more income.
To reset on their careers. And we're short on time, Joshua. I want Danielle to be able to respond to that thread. Go ahead.
Well, I wish that $20 an hour was the magic number because that's what we're paying. And there are many, many in the Milwaukee County area that are paying a starting wage of 17 at entry-level positions for dishwashers and in excess of 20 for anyone with skills in the cooking area. I don't think it's wage alone. I don't think there's a silver bullet that can solve the very, very complex workforce issue. We need more bodies. We need more bodies to fill positions, and we need to find a way to get the people who want to work to the places who have the jobs.
Of course, in the last few moments, holiday season very busy for restaurants. Do you anticipate more closures in the new year?
Absolutely. I think by the first of the year, we will see a significant uptick in closures of restaurants who are holding on and hoping that the holiday season makes or breaks the year, and hopefully it's not as significant as I fear. I hope that the holidays are good for everybody.
Danielle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Danielle Bearwald, board chair of one of the largest trade groups in the state, the Wisconsin Restaurant Association, and owner of Irv's Mug in Oak Creek. Just ahead, a panel of brewers from around the state discuss beer and the craft brewing industry. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.